from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With burning smartphones and the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 recall underway, the world is turning its attention to batteries, lithium-ion batteries, powering the world at a cost. Before that battery can power your phone, men and children mine cobalt in astonishing conditions in Congo. Clouds of graphite coat fields and towns in China. It's pretty eye-opening what goes into giving you that hot little power pack. This hour On Point, lithium-ion batteries and their human, inhuman cost. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know what goes into that power pack in your pocket, in your phone, your car? Joining me first today to look at Samsung's burning phone problem is Brian Barrett, senior writer for Wired. He joins us from Birmingham, Alabama. Brian, thanks very much for being with us. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
What happened here?
Well, that's a big question. I think the scariest thing is that no one still really knows exactly in terms of what actually went wrong with the battery. But what we do know is Samsung started selling the Galaxy Note 7 on August 19th. It's their marquee product, a huge product for them every single year, their best bet to go up against the iPhone. Within a week, there was a report of an explosion in South Korea. Within 2 weeks, just about, Samsung announced a global recall of 2.7 million of these phones, saying the batteries were faulty. And then it only got worse from there. They started to try to replace the phones. The replacement phones had problems as well. Until eventually Samsung just had to say, look, we're going to pull the plug on this. Everyone, please send back your phones, get a new one. And the Note 7 is now gone, but not before a lot of damage has been done.
And the next thing you know, here's what we were hearing. This from ABC News.
Now to a frightening headline about your smartphone. Samsung delaying shipments of its Galaxy Note 7 amid reports of exploding batteries, and that announcement sending their stock plummeting. ABC's Rebecca Jarvis is here with the latest. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Amy. Multiple consumers have now complained of explosions of their Galaxy Note 7 devices.
Brian Barrett at Wired, in early September, Samsung said this was because of a very rare manufacturing process error. But we're also reading here that as you get to higher energy density and faster charging in a battery, the barrier to explosion becomes less and less. Are we pushing the boundaries here?
You know, I think there's a fair case to be made there. And until Samsung gives their full rundown of what exactly happened, because clearly whatever they thought it was at first, the manufacturer is not what ended up happening.
How do we know that?
Because they had sent out a million replacement phones that continued to then catch on fire. And then I think have yet to say, okay, no, this time we got it. And that's one reason I think we're seeing that they're not taking another stab at it. I think if they knew for sure that they had this fixed, then I think that we would still have this phone on the shelves. It's a huge product for them. And having to pull it is going to have really serious repercussions for them. So, but I do think that we are pushing lithium-ion batteries about as far as we can go. Because, you know, consumers, it's the number one consumer complaint is I wish my smartphone lasted longer. I wish I didn't have to plug it in near the end of the day. And so it's that trade-off when we go for thinner and thinner phones that last longer and longer. We do sort of push these things to their limit.
And, of course, these batteries are not just in cell phones. I mean, in the past year, you've had Sony, HP, Toshiba, Panasonic. They've already called laptop battery packs. We had Boeing with its problems on board a passenger liner. And again, it looks as one just has to wonder, is our desire for smaller, higher power, faster charging pushing us right out to the limits of this technology?
You know, I think that's part of it. And lithium-ion batteries, it is a good point. They're in basically every consumer product and larger things, like even airplanes, as you mentioned.
And small things like those hoverboard toys, so-called hoverboards,
exactly.
Right?
I think for the most part, I don't think it's something where we need to be concerned about all of a sudden every phone is a potential fire hazard. Part of it is that it is also still a very complex technology. It's something we've been doing for a long time, but I think that's part of it is when you try to fit more and more into a smaller space, those complexities really come to bear a little bit more. I don't think it's time for overarching concern. Even within Samsung, the Note 7 is the only product that we know of that has this problem within Samsung. They sell other smartphones that do not have this defect. But it is something to be aware of in terms of, you know, this is a technology we still need to take very seriously. We still need to sort of treat it with respect and care, especially because there's really not anything coming next anytime soon. There's not this horizon where within a few years we'll be using something different. We're stuck with lithium-ion for a while.
We're going to be looking at exactly what might be out there on the horizon, how soon that might come, or how long that might take. Right now, I'm quoting here Kichahu, he's with Solid Energy Systems, saying a battery is really a bomb that releases its energy in a controlled way. And Samsung finding it in not such a controlled way recently, with big implications for them, their business, and the broader industry. Brian Baird in Birmingham, Alabama, with Wired. Thanks for joining us for a minute today, Brian.
Thank you.
I want to turn to Washington right now, and two reporters from The Washington Post who have been writing about ingredients in lithium-ion batteries and how those ingredients are sourced, the human cost of getting them into your smartphone, and much more. With us now from Washington, Todd Frankel, reporter for The Washington Post. Todd, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And Peter Wariski, also a reporter for The Washington Post. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You've been writing about graphite and cobalt in lithium-ion batteries, many of which, of course, end up in our cell phones. Todd, what role, let me go first to you on cobalt. It's lithium-ion. We don't hear cobalt in there. What's the role of cobalt in a lithium-ion battery?
Cobalt is found in the battery cathode, which is one half of the battery. There's an anode and there's a cathode. And cobalt is found, especially in smartphone batteries and laptop batteries, it's pretty much a solid cobalt cathode. And so there's 5 to 10 grams of cobalt inside your smartphone. It's throughout the product chain, but especially in smartphones and laptops.
And they need a cobalt cathode. Why not something else? Why not just, I don't know, steel?
Yeah, it's cobalt has special properties. They've actually tried to make batteries without cobalt inside of it, but cobalt is found to just be very good for storing energy and making things work much better.
More efficiently. And graphite, Peter, you've looked at graphite. Todd looked at cobalt in Congo. You looked at graphite in China. What's the role of graphite in a lithium-ion battery?
So graphite, the main ingredient in most anodes, which is the negative part of the battery, the negative electrode.
Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of, what, half the battery's cobalt and half of it is graphite?
No, it's not quite that simple. The cathodes tend to have two or three or four different chemicals in there, and the anode tends to be almost all graphite.
We think of graphite as something, I don't know, is it pencils, lubricants?
Yeah. When I was at one of the mines, I was delighted to pick up a rock and then start scribbling in my notebook with it. It's the exact same stuff that's in our pencils.
And the mines you were looking at were in China?
Right. China has grown over the last few decades into the largest producer of graphite in the world. I think it's like about two-thirds of the graphite in the world comes from China. And they've seen a market. It's been used for all kinds of things, but now the new boom is in batteries.
So begin to take us into the human cost of these, Todd. When we see the smartphones on display in the Apple Store, you name it, I mean the Samsung, they look shiny and marvelous. But you've gone to the source of these elements that are included, and it looks pretty grim there. What's the problem on the cobalt side?
Cobalt, 60% of the world's cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And much of that cobalt that's mined there is actually done by hand. It's not done by industrial mines. It has the sort of funny name of artisanal cobalt, artisanal mining. And it's done by hand. These guys go underground digging with axes and picks and shovels and tunneling, hundreds of feet underground and prying it out by hand. No safety equipment, no helmets, no shoring up of the mine walls. This is done with very little supervision all over the place. It's sort of a very wild scene there. And it's been going on, for many years, if not decades.
I mean, I'm looking at photographs here of it looks like sort of hills and mountaintops just riddled with trenches and holes and guys everywhere with shovels headed down in there and maybe children too.
Yeah, no, there are children in the mines that everyone admits to that. It's so lightly regulated. It's an incredibly poor country. And so where we were in Kolwezi, which is a city in southern western Congo, there was children there. It's hundreds of thousands of miners all just going at it, just trying to eke out whatever they can as a living. And the cobalt, provides them a livelihood, not much of one, but it's certainly a livelihood.
We'll look at what it means to be down in those mines, how cobalt comes out of there, the so-called cobalt pipeline. What about on the graphite side, Peter? What's the problem?
Well, we went to 5 different places in 2 different provinces where graphite is either mined or processed. And every place we went, we got the same complaints from all the people, which is that the water's been polluted because of the plant, so much so that they can smell the water. They hold their hands over their noses when they cross some of the little local waterways. And even more worse than that is that there's dust in the air everywhere all the time, and it settles on everything. They're breathing it in, and they feel like it's harming their health.
What part of China are these graphite mines and processing plants in?
One is way, way up near Russia in Heilongjiang province, if I've that's an approximate pronunciation, and then Shandong province, a place called Pingdu. Actually, most of the mines are up in the north. They ship it south where it's processed. And in both places, both with the mines and with the processing is done with heavy-duty chemicals that are highly toxic and usually not used in chemical refining in other parts of the world, but they are used in China. It does terrible things to the water. One guy told me that the waters in the river don't freeze anymore in the wintertime.
I mean, there was a time when there were towns and cities all over that were coated in coal dust, still some in China. Is it worse than what we saw in the old Industrial Revolution in the U.S., this power source for a very high-tech product now?
That's a good question. It's something I thought about a lot. I think it's – I don't know the answer to it, but I think one of the big differences is that there was what I found most troubling is that it was unclear whether there was the will or the opportunity for the people to put their foot down and say, let's fix this, because people were afraid to talk to us and tell us that there's something wrong.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about what goes into lithium-ion batteries for your smartphone, electric cars, hoverboards, jets, the human cost of lithium batteries in Congo, in China, and beyond may surprise you. Todd Frankel and Peter Wariski have been writing about this for The Washington Post. Very compelling pieces you can link to at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us this hour. Has the Samsung fiasco, burning phones, got you thinking about lithium-ion batteries again? Do you know what goes into powering your cell phone? Can you picture the sort of hellhole cobalt mining in Congo, the towns in China smothered in graphite? Does that shiny end product overwhelm our awareness of what goes into it? Todd Frankel and Peter Wariski brought back some sound and visuals as well from Africa, from China. Here's the sound of a Washington Post video of Congolese women washing recently mined cobalt and copper in a nearby river that's also used for irrigation, for fishing, for bathing. And you're right there in Congo, where all this happens. Also talked with a couple on the other side of the world in Jidong in Heilongjiang province in China near a graphite factory about what the factory has done to their crops. They ask, what do you grow? The wife says, corn. The reporter says, is the corn affected by the graphite? Husband says, it's covered in black. Wife, the entire field is black. We use machines now, but if you work in the field, your whole face is black after you get out. Peter Wariski was in China reporting on that for The Washington Post. Todd Frankel in Congo on cobalt. Todd, paint a picture for us so that when people pick up their phones and think about what's in there and where it came from, they can really understand some of the scenes that you saw and the consequences of those scenes.
So the mines were the cobalt mines in the Congo. You had the men, and it's almost predominantly men and children who go into these mines. And it's nothing like you see like the West Virginia coal mine, you know, with the hard hats and the rails and the trucks going in. These guys are going in often barefoot, just into these worn holes right underground. They have these little miner lamps that they buy in the village. And they're just picking away at the seams in the underground, doing this entirely by hand. The only mechanized process there is they actually pump air underground so they don't suffocate. But when we were there, when we were visiting, two miners died in a cave-in. Four more had to be rescued from an underground fire. And talking to people, deaths are incredibly common. It's incredibly dangerous work. And then when they pull it out, and then they, as you play that audio, They take it and they wash it in the rivers, polluting the rivers that everyone uses for bathing and drinking. And then from there, it's taken to a small market where it is then sold to enters the international supply chain. And that's where it ends up and going out to all the different smartphones and laptops around the world.
We heard women there washing in the rivers, women involved at that stage, obviously children as well. How common is the presence of children working in these mines in Congo?
They're a small proportion. They mostly do it for subsistence and also to pay for school fees. And we were talking to the local governor there, and he said that one of the problems they have is there's nothing else for these kids to do. And you know, they're underground working because they need the money. It's a well enough known problem. The Department of Labor lists Congolese cobalt as likely being made by child labor. I mean, there's certainly no secret about this going on. It's just about whether it's being more widely recognized throughout, if consumers know this.
How big a problem? Apple did an audit, it says, in 2014 and found 16 underage workers out of a workforce of 1.6 million. And it said those cases were successfully addressed. What about that?
Well, I think that they're not exactly looking all the way back to their different suppliers. We found with this one cobalt company called CDM, a mining company, you know, Apple had very little contact with them and probably had no idea what's going on. And CDM admits that they never looked at their supply chain outside of their gates. So in other words, these miners do not work for them. Everyone's a freelancer. That's the artisanal. They're going out there and mining it by hand and bringing it to them. And they never ask questions looking further back in the supply chain. So there's absolutely no way for these companies to know without really, really looking much harder than they have previously.
Artisanal makes it sound like a nice meal in a fancy restaurant, but this is anything. But what about the health consequences? Are there others? Is exposure to cobalt a problem or not?
Exposure to cobalt can lead to something called hard metal lung disease, which is sort of like black lung disease that coal miners get. But also, you know, when you're unearthing this cobalt, you're unearthing all sorts of other minerals. Uranium, there's plenty of uranium in the ground there. Actually, a Congolese mine supplied the uranium to the original atomic bomb that the U.S. used. So all this stuff's coming out along with the cobalt exposing to people. And medical studies have shown that in the blood and urine of people who live in this area have incredibly high rates of metals. And there's birth defects and, you know, just different problems that they're just beginning to figure out is probably tied back to the mining.
Once the cobalt comes out of the ground in Congo, you describe it as heading into the cobalt pipeline. Where does that lead? Where are most lithium ion batteries actually put together, made?
It all leads back pretty much to China and Korea. That's where the main places are. So the mining industry actually in Congo in recent years has become dominated by Chinese companies who want to get these raw materials. The largest mine in Congo used to be a U.S.-owned company. It actually was recently bought by the Chinese. And so now 90% of the cobalt coming out of the Congo heads its way to China and Asia.
There you pick it up, Peter Wariski, with the graphite element of this. You all spoke with a woman named Li Jie, who lives in Liumai in Heilongjiang province, about the graphite dust from a factory near her. She says, the wind blows the dust over. It's white and sparkling, and you can't wash it off. Chinese reporter says, can you tell us where the dust comes from? And she says, right over there. There's a factory, a chimney. Peter, describe the scene for us in these towns and villages and the farms that surround them.
Well, that particular place, Liumao, is very beautiful, very scenic. The photographer almost killed himself jumping out of the cab. He wanted to take photographs. It was just incredibly beautiful. There's rice paddies all around. It's a rural area, but up on the mountain, just a little bit, maybe a mile or less than a mile away, is this place where they're mining and refining graphite. And it was a kind of a strange image for pollution, but it had this kind of fairy tale quality in that, you know, the people say at night the air sparkles. And the reason it sparkles is that graphite is reflective, and if there's a little bit of light, it hits it. And the problem is that you wake up in the morning and you're covered in soot.
What are the health consequences of the sort of omnipresent graphite dust then? I guess that's what you're describing, in the towns and beyond them, just covering sort of everything.
Right. There's the Chinese expression, I think it's a regional expression, it's Mai Tai. We think of them as drinks, but Mai Tai, it just means filthy and dirty, and it makes everything Mai Tai. the health consequences are sort of just part of the general problem of pollution in China, where I think they estimate there's a million premature deaths every year because of air pollution. And the particular problem is particulate matter in the air, and graphite is one of those constituents of particulate matter.
So are we talking lung disease, or what specifically?
You're pointing
this is an outrage, and I want to hear where the outrage ends up.
Well, it's lung disease, it's heart disease. The epidemiologists, I'm not quite sure what their methodology is, but it's a million premature deaths a year. It's one of the difficulties that we had in this story, and also the water has 700 times the limits of certain chemicals in it. The problem with any story in China on pollution is, where did the pollution actually come from? We know that some of it came from graphite, but how much of the rest came from other sources? It's difficult to know, but it's pretty clear that in total there's a massive effect.
Did you find Chinese people living in these graphite mining and processing zones upset about it? Are they looking for help in getting away from it? Is the government focused on this in China?
That's a really good question, and it's a little bit of a complicated answer. There were a lot of people who were upset about it. Fewer people who were willing to talk to us about it. There were many times we'd start a conversation and they would say, no, I can't talk anymore. That's the village official, the Communist Party official from the village was coming up, and they didn't want to be caught talking to a Western journalist about this. The government has cracked down once or twice in each province. It's what the people said is that was just a show. They closed the mines briefly, and then they reopened, and the pollution is pretty much the same as it was before the government crackdown.
And what about companies who are using this graphite in their lithium-ion batteries or further down the supply chain in smartphones and beyond? Are they worried about it? What did they say when you came to them?
Another good question. The back and forth that Todd and I had with the companies lasted more than, 4-6 weeks. It wasn't clear that they knew where their supply chain led because we got contradictory answers. Panasonic said that they had investigated one of the factories that I had mentioned and had corrected the problem. It wasn't clear what problem or what factory. Samsung said it was looking into it. We didn't get a lot of clarity from the companies, and at least part of that we think is that they have not really checked and don't have a good they haven't managed their supply chain as well as they may have claimed to the public.
Todd Frankel, I'm reading here in your reporting Apple saying that they don't want to find remedies aimed at just making the supply chain look pretty. What you found wasn't pretty. I mean, starting next year, Apple will internally treat cobalt as a conflict mineral. What exactly does that mean?
So conflict minerals in the Congo, in 2010, the U.S. passed a law, part of the Dodd-Frank legislation, requiring for a certain group of minerals known as 3TNG, which are three minor minerals in gold. Coming out of the Congo, they were worried that they were being used to fund militias and fund the ongoing civil war in the Congo. Mm-hmm. And so companies, when they were required to report to the SEC and saying that they – proving that they did due diligence on their supply chain, that they tried their hardest to verify exactly where these minerals, these minor minerals came from, and that they did not come from mines that were connected to wars – the idea then is that scrutiny has actually been quite beneficial. It's fairly controversial exactly how it works. But in the end, it's fairly – people have to know exactly where their minerals are coming from. And if cobalt was to be the same scrutiny applied to cobalt, then perhaps some of these problems would go away. If Apple was required takes it upon itself to actually examine and zero down right down to those mines on the ground there in Kolwezi and finding out where their cobalt comes from, that these problems would not be allowed to persist.
We're talking about cobalt and graphite, key elements in your smartphone and a lot more in lithium-ion batteries, and the human cost that comes with their extraction and processing. I mean, Todd, conflict minerals, we heard a lot about blood diamonds. These drew a lot of attention because the money from them was funding conflict. But are you really talking about that here with cobalt in Congo? Is it just the health consequences of mine cave-ins and all the rest?
No, yeah, and we're not talking about cobalt funding wars or anything like that. But as a result of the conflict of minerals scrutiny, the conditions at these mines got a lot better for the minor minerals and gold. And so the thinking is that if companies were to scrutinize and know their supply chains as well that you do for conflict minerals, if they were to do that for cobalt, then therefore we would learn they would not allow these things to go on. Some of the health problems would be much more difficult to eradicate. The pollution and, these guys are going to go underground and be exposed to these things, and you're going to be washing the minerals in the water. These things are going to be ongoing. But we need to discuss them and sort of realize that they're happening, and perhaps there's ways to alleviate some of that.
We've got callers for you from Middlebury, Vermont. Robin is calling. Robin, you're on with Todd Frankel and Peter Wariski. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hey, this is great that you guys are bringing this attention to mining, which is, extraction has always been the worst form of environmental pollution. But my question is how you avoid the collateral damage from exoticism. I've worked for decades with the electronics repair and reuse and recycling fields overseas, and I cringe when I see people taking pictures of ethnic minorities recycling and repairing electronics and people associating the poverty with wrongdoing and the urge for boycotts.
Are you suggesting that going and looking at the conditions of miners in Congo or villagers in China is exoticizing? What exactly do you mean, Robin?
I don't think that this is, but I saw what happened to the, quote, e-waste field where people overseas in Africa were importing, repairing, and reusing devices. And I was aware of people reacting to the poverty or to the color of the people that were performing the activity. And it just makes me cringe when people aren't doing the math, aren't looking at it scientifically.
I appreciate your call. Peter, are you all engaged in exoticism here, looking at the source woes in China and Congo?
I don't think so. We just went to the Congo and to China because that's where the minerals were being kept from. I'm not quite sure how to answer that question.
Todd?
I think it perhaps he's indicating, there's some people have been like, what can we do? And, I think the worst thing we could do is perhaps urge a boycott of these nations. Like, in other words, let's stop getting our cobalt from the Congo. Well, one, that's going to be pretty much impossible since 60% of the world supply comes from there. But a boycott's not the answer. I think the answer perhaps is requiring better conditions for the workers there, saying, hey, companies, you can do a better job making sure these workers are not treated in this way, rather than turning our backs on them. Somehow we don't want to see this anymore.
The caller says get your numbers right. Maybe the suggestion there is that it's not cost effective. People want their cheap smartphones You want to have like nice homes and everybody with, a picket fence and a brand new, you name it, in Congo. It's not going to happen.
Well, I think along the lines of cost effectiveness, you're right. They save money. Artisanal cobalt is cheaper. Polluting factories in China are cheaper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. However, those companies go out and tell the public that they're doing things to make sure that their supply chain is clean. And I think customers trust the companies to do the right thing. I don't think we saw that. And I think consumers ought to, if they're going to be making a choice on price, I suppose we can let them. But they shouldn't be. They should at least be fully informed of the costs around the world of the products they're buying.
Yeah, I don't think any company wants to be associated with what we saw on the ground there. And so whether it maybe adds a couple cents or even a dollar to the final product, I think they're willing to invest that money. It's just about where they focus those resources.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Goldman Sachs. Get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy in the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth, plus much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about what goes into lithium-ion batteries for your phone, electric cars, hoverboards, jets. The human cost of lithium batteries in Congo, in China, and beyond may surprise you. You can join us this hour at 800-423-8255. What's your question on Congo cobalt, on China graphite? Is there a better way to power up the devices we so depend on now? Are these pretty terrible stories going to make you, anyone, step away from those devices? Todd Frankel and Peter Walrisky are with us from The Washington Post. They went out to Congo, to China, and saw some pretty harrowing scenes of how those ingredients for lithium-ion batteries central to cell phones and much more are pulled out of the ground and processed there. In just a moment, we'll talk with Don Sadoway from MIT. He's thinking about alternatives on the battery front. Todd and Peter, I want to play a little tape from you. This is from CNBC. This is Henk van Alphen. He's CEO of something called Wealth Minerals, and he was put on the spot maybe as a consequence of your reporting about lithium-ion batteries and the toll of them, maybe Samsung's, but also at their source. He said, well, okay, but there's a lot of benefits here, and I wonder what you think of that. Let's listen.
There's millions and millions of batteries out there, and it has been very relatively few incidents. But it's a technology that's not that old. But, you know, the other side of that is it's going to save millions and millions of life, you know, anti-pollution situations around the world. So, you know, you have to sort of kind of see the benefits of lithium batteries coming into the market.
Look at the benefits. Having come back from seeing those fields of miners risking their lives in Congo, Todd, how do you feel about that now? Cell phones and lots of other things powered by lithium-ion batteries make all kinds of convenience and capacity. But there's the human cost. How do you weigh those?
Yeah, I don't think it's an either or proposition. We all love our smartphones. We, you know, depend on it, and I don't think we need to say that. I agree with him that they're much better than, you know, polluting the air through, you know, gasoline, diesel engines, or however we're used to making energy. I think we've just shown that there is a cost to these lithium ion batteries, and that we could probably do better even on this end as well.
So we just go and buy our next smartphone and, you know, in a shiny store and keep on dialing, and the kid dies in Congo?
Well, no. I think what this is about is putting more attention on the problem, right? And so companies respond to scrutiny. They respond to, you know, legislation. They respond to different incentives. And so if there's enough attention on this problem, perhaps things would then change. I don't think anyone would defend the practices on the ground that we saw either in China or in Congo.
Let's get a call from Leominster, Massachusetts. Jean is calling. Hi, Jean. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Jean Makelela. I am from Democratic Republic of Congo. We have broken heart to see how many people are killed in Congo because of the mineral coltan and cobalt they use in the high-tech technology. It is over 1 million people killed in it now. Even the American president doesn't want even to talk about, even the radio. Nobody is talking about that crime that's worse than the two First and Second World War combined.
Well, I don't know about that, but we're talking about it right now, Jean. You're from Congo. What do you think should be done? What should be done?
Yeah, the American government should stop the companies from buying those minerals from the war zones. But no one state passed the law. Only New Hampshire, all the states, they refused to pass the type of law.
What about the kinds of steps that might be taken, Peter Walrisky? There's Jean from Congo, and he puts a number on the number of deaths. First of all, do you see, in China, we're not talking war, we're not talking conflict mineral exactly. We're talking environmental damage. But what about the effectiveness of legislation or oversight? Does it just get lost in the global supply chain?
I think the main way that this problem or the problems that we saw are going to get solved is through pressure on the companies. None of them want to be associated with these problems. I don't know how one national government could solve it, because the problem with, say, an Apple iPhone or Samsung is that it crosses borders, and it's difficult. It's kind of a high bar for a government to set everything in an iPhone. We have to know exactly where it came from, But I think it's if it's something a company as big as and rich as Apple, and same with Samsung and Panasonic, I think it's within their wherewithal to do a better job, and it's where in their best interest to do a better job, as long as people know that there are these problems associated with them.
Is it trackable and addressable if companies, governments wanted that done, Todd?
You can do a pretty good job, actually, and I think that's been shown with the conflict minerals law, which requires tracking all along the way, with tagging and independent monitoring, and it's expensive. I mean, you know, the companies have fought this when it originally passed in 2010. I know the Chamber of Commerce is not a big fan of this.
You mean the original conflict minerals legislation?
Right, which set up the mechanism for how to track minerals. Some people said it was impossible. It was going to cost like $6 billion a year, and it's proven to not be quite that expensive. It does a pretty good job. Now, it's controversial. There's some problems with it. It's not a perfect system. But it can be done. I mean, it takes a lot of work and effort and, you know, public pressure. I mean, people have to sort of demand this.
Sarah in Columbia, Missouri. Thank you for calling, Sarah. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I saw the video that these gentlemen placed online, and it just really caused a large amount of cognitive dissonance because I can't justify the suffering that my phone is causing. And I'm just wondering, for people like me who want to have an alternative, what is the alternative? Is there going to be an alternative, or is this going to just take a social shift, much in the way as free trade organics and fair trade, pardon me, organics and diamonds? And I'll be happy to take my call answer off the air.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call. Todd, Peter, stand by. To go at that question of whether or not there's an alternative, I want to welcome Don Sadoway into our conversation here. He's a professor of materials chemistry at MIT. He's done some very big research on alternatives to lithium-ion batteries, and he's hip deep in it right now. Don Sadoway, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be back.
If people don't like the consequences of lithium-ion batteries, they don't like what goes into them and the human suffering that costs. Are there alternatives on the horizon or at hand right now, Don? Can we have lots of power in small packages like smartphones? Are there better alternatives now?
There are alternatives in the pipeline. They're not commercially viable just yet. But the good news is that we haven't hit the ceiling on the electrochemistry, and there are some candidate possibilities for say 5 years down the road. But I will say that the lithium-ion battery today, the issues that you've been talking about are issues of execution. I can give you a different battery chemistry that'll be safer and have more energy in a smaller volume. But if the original sourcing of the materials is done in a haphazard way, the human suffering isn't going to be alleviated.
So you're saying you could clean up the sourcing of these and maybe lithium-ion batteries wouldn't be so bad?
Yes, you could clean up the sourcing. That's different from the phones that have been catching fire. I mean,
of
those
course.
Are two different questions.
Yes, but I mean, fundamentally, it doesn't have to have this human cost. If the graphite were processed with more care, if the cobalt mining process was held to a different standard, I guess you're suggesting lithium-ion might not be so bad.
That's correct.
What about on the burning phones and Samsung? Is that inevitable as we get higher energy density and people want faster charging for their phones?
No, it's not inevitable. The lithium-ion chemistry has some dangers associated with it. Because the electrolyte, the liquid in between the electrodes, is a liquid that's volatile and inflammable. So under the wrong conditions, it can catch fire. But there are preventative measures. You put separators in there and so on and so forth. So my suspicion here is that Samsung was trying to put more energy into a smaller volume and maybe also cut costs. And in spite of all of their bench testing, whatever the condition is that causes these fires, it didn't manifest itself in their screening. And so the curse here is that after the phone has been damaged, you've lost your evidence. So it's not an easy matter to diagnose.
If people don't feel confident that the Democratic Republic of Congo, or for that matter China, will really take the steps to clean up cobalt mining or graphite processing, if they'd rather just have an alternate to lithium-ion batteries, where's the research these days? Is there a lot of research going on for alternatives? Where's the center of gravity in research on the battery front?
I go to the university. The university is the font of new technology, and that's where the radical innovation is taking place.
Where's most of the research in the field of batteries focused right now?
Incremental improvements to lithium ion, trying to make them more energy dense, try to keep them operating longer. We all know what the effect of cycling them is. You know, you get your phone on the first day, you're really excited, and then after about 2 years of daily use, it doesn't run quite as long as it did on day one. So those are problems that people are addressing.
Anne in Essex, Massachusetts. Anne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be able to speak with you. I was wondering whether solar batteries could be a possible replacement for these. And also, the second point, that there's a lot of very serious health impact on the receiving end of these telephones to the human brain and DNA and immune system. And George Carlo, who was working with Motorola, hired as their medical person, discovered how dangerous mobile phones were and was immediately fired. He's written a book about cell phones and their dangers. So we need a safe way to communicate with each other.
And I appreciate your call. Let us look at those. We're talking about what goes into the lithium-ion batteries that end up in your smartphone and much more. Don Sadoway at MIT, does the idea of a solar battery even make sense to you? Do those two things go together? Solar can, be used to create energy, but a solar battery?
I don't know what she's referring to. You can use a solar energy to convert
charge
it,
up. Mm-hmm.
To charge up. Of course, if you're indoors or if it's after dark, that's not going to work either. I don't know.
So what are the alternatives? I mean, lithium's been very popular because you can pack a lot of energy into a small space. Are there alternatives out there?
Yeah, there are several alternatives. I've got a short list. There are some people looking at sodium in lieu of lithium, but my two favorites are magnesium and ultimately aluminum. In my judgment, if we could make a battery based on aluminum, we'd have something that is powerful, safe, and cheap. Aluminum is the third most abundant element in the Earth's crust, and let's go for it.
What's the challenge with that? If you can put it in terms that we can follow, is it difficult? Is it unknown how to make aluminum a great battery base?
Yes, the chemistry is unknown. I mean, we know what to do for the negative electrode for the anode. That's aluminum foil. I can buy that in the grocery store right now. And the electrolyte, that's the solution between the electrodes. We've got some pretty good ideas on what that would be. The big mystery is what would be the material that would operate as the positive electrode, the cathode. And that's where the research has to go. Once we have that, we've got our solution.
Where's the first target for most battery research that's looking beyond lithium ion? Is it for large-scale batteries? We heard about the need to be able to store energy that might be produced by solar or by wind, other alternative energy sources. Is it large-scale energy storage that is the battery research focus, or is it small-scale for, smartphones and hoverboards?
It's both. And the applications are so radically different that the kinds of batteries that lend themselves to stationary storage for storing grid and solar and wind, those batteries are intrinsically different from the kinds of batteries that go into your pocket. And so those are separate streams of research.
Don Sadoway at MIT, professor of materials chemistry there. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Todd Frankel, Peter Wariski, what do you think about this notion of alternatives coming in here that would take us fundamentally away from this kind of battery as an alternative to the woe that you found in the field?
I think it's interesting. The one thing he stumbled on was, the idea of what's going to be a better cathode, and the cobalt's in the cathode. I think we're stuck with cobalt for a while. And these miners down there, it's not that they didn't want to be miners. They need this work. They need this employment. They need the money.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think it's about, there's ways to do it better. I mean, I think rather than finding some new product, I think there's a way to what we're doing right now, we can do it better.
Peter, what's the image that's going to most stick in your mind from your reporting in China on graphite processing?
Oh, wow. A lot of them. I mean, people pumping water out of their little well and it being sort of filthy and covered different oils, and people wiping their windowsill or wiping the desk they just cleaned an hour ago with their, you know, fingers dirty with graphite. There was a everywhere we looked, they're also being followed by company officials or political people. We were never entirely sure at all of the different plants that we went to.
And Todd, what about you in Africa? A lasting image that will stay with you when you fire up your smartphone?
Probably being at this one mine called Tilwa Zembe, which is a massive mine with hundreds. There were hundreds of guys working underground, but it was utterly silent, except for like the muffled, like clink of metal on stone underground. But you know, this giant mine, and it was entirely non-industrial. It was silent. It was kind of a jarring image.
Who's pushing? Who's pushing for change here? Who's pushing for more responsibility all the way up the supply chain?
NGOs are pushing for this quite hard. Amnesty and Global Witness, many of them are fighting this battle and have been doing this for a couple of years. It's just about getting this to a broader attention.
Well, we're very grateful for the reporting that you've done in the field so that we can know better what's going on up the supply chain. Grateful to you also for being with us today. Peter Walrisky and Todd Frankel at The Washington Post. Thank you very much to you both.
Yeah, thanks,
Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.